Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and my next guest works in international development, helping lift women and their families out of poverty around the world. And as she's found out in her long career, teaching women around the world to succeed economically involves a lot more than just lending them some money and telling them to get to work. My guest is Ritu Sharma, the co-founder of Women Thrive Worldwide, an advocacy organization that brings the interests of women to the attention of policymakers in D.C. And she's the author of a new book called Teach a Woman to Fish, Overcoming Poverty Around the Globe. Hi, Ritu. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi. How are you?
Okay. Thank you. And I see the book starts out in Sri Lanka and tells the stories of women in the wake of the huge 2004 tsunami. And you explain why the tsunami actually harmed and killed more women than men, and tell how as soon as you heard about the disaster, you knew that would be the case. Why did it happen like that?
Well, there's lots and lots of reasons why natural disasters or even man-made disasters hit women harder than men. But in the case of that tsunami, it was very basic things like women did not learn how to swim. And men did, or women were not just strong enough to hold on to a tree or a telephone pole. They couldn't run as fast as men. Or if the wave ripped their clothes off, they were too nervous. They were too shy to stand up and run naked away from the wave. So, you know, lots of reasons, cultural, physical. But in some villages in Sri Lanka, you know, the number of adults that died were almost 90%. Women as compared to men.
90%? That's incredible.
Yeah.
The women you profile in your book who are from Sri Lanka, from Honduras and Nicaragua, places that we talked about earlier in the show with the wave of children, undocumented immigrants coming on their own, Burkina Faso, working to get themselves out of poverty despite structural discrimination and expectations that work to keep them down. But these women aren't purely lifting themselves up by their bootstraps, though there's a lot of that. You argue that it takes a lot of outside support and training. Where would you start?
Well, one point I'm trying to make in the book is that even if poor women are working extremely hard, which they do, they work 17 hours a day fetching water and firewood and on their farms and cooking, and that there are things outside of them that we need to change that are keeping them poor. And just take the case of the women who survived the tsunami. I went back a few years after the tsunami and talked with women about what they were experiencing. And one of the things they all talked about was that the taxes on day-to-day goods had skyrocketed as a result of the tsunami. The government needed more revenue to finance reconstruction. And they were collecting that revenue basically by taxing sugar, flour, salt, tea, the basic things that all families in Sri Lanka need. But that tax was very difficult for people in poverty to pay, and it raised the cost of their living by 60 or 70%. You know, a wealthy person in Sri Lanka, not a problem. They can pay twice as much for tea. But someone living in poverty, that really sapped their resources and their ability to come back from the tsunami. So it's not just as simple as a microenterprise loan or sending a girl to school. Those are really important things. But we actually have to look at the broader system that is sometimes taxing people into poverty.
That's so interesting that you bring up microlending in anything but positive and glowing and unambiguous terms, because it seems to me that for years now it's been touted as the new best way to support women around the world who are the ones who get most of the microloans more than men and start these businesses. And a lot of the projects that your group, Women Thrive, works on operate on a similar model. But you warn against some of these microloan organizations in the book, and you give some advice for Westerners who want to go that route to donate money. So when, in your opinion, should people be wary of this model?
Well, a couple of things to look for. One thing that's happened with this model of microcredit is how they measure their success. And a number of organizations measure their success by how many loans they make and what percentage of loans is repaid. And as we all know, what gets measured gets done. So what these organizations are doing is they're trying to loan more and more and more money, which means they're sort of pushing it out there on women in poverty and men as well, and then they really push people hard to repay. So that statistic looks good as well. And what often happens is, you know, women in poverty can't turn a profit on their loan very quickly, and it may take them longer to repay. And what they end up doing is taking money from their budget to feed their children to pay back the microenterprise loan because that organization is putting so much pressure on them to repay. What we want organizations to really be looking at is how many of the women that take loans 5 years later are no longer taking loans. How many of them have actually created successful businesses that have lifted their families out of poverty? Not just, well, they're making a few extra cents a day, so they're not in extreme poverty anymore, but they're still in poverty. You know, for us, that's not what we're trying to do with microcredit. We're not trying to take people from being extremely poor to just really poor. We really are trying to end poverty. So what people need to do is when you give money to a microcredit agency, ask them how they measure their success. What do they count? What are they looking at? What's important to them? And if all you hear is, well, 98% of our loans are repaid and every year we're lending more and more, those are not the kind of things that you want to be measuring.
That's fascinating. Another counterintuitive thing, you write that almost 40% of the world's population is farmers, and the majority of those are women who farm small plots to feed themselves and their families. This is not the, you know, American Gothic painting image of the farm family that many listeners may have. More than half the world's farmers are women?
Yeah, it is counterintuitive based on, you know, what we learned in our storybooks growing up. But the common picture of a farmer in Africa is a woman with a baby on her back. And most of the food that Africans eat is actually grown by women. And what's very interesting is that men and women actually grow different things. Men tend to grow cash crops or, you know, corn, soy, sorghum, things, grains that they can then sell in the market. Women will help their husbands on their farms. That's a big part of their responsibility. But they will also grow vegetables, kitchen gardens that are the greens and the tomatoes and the fruits and vegetables that actually provide most of the family's nutrition, because you can't survive on soy alone. So it's really...
Are you promoting subsistence agriculture over cash crop agriculture?
No. The important thing, like anything in life, is how it's done. So what we're saying is, if you want to take women into cash crops so that they can increase their income, you have to look at the whole system, right? So if you're going to take all the women in a village and get them to start growing rice, you need to figure out how are they going to either continue to grow the vegetables, or where are those vegetables going to come from? Now that if they have money from growing rice, where are they going to buy those nutritious foods? Is the market going to provide them? So you've got to look at, well, maybe we don't get everybody growing rice. Maybe we take one women's cooperative and we encourage them to do rice production, but then we take another women's cooperative and encourage them to do vegetable production so that they can then do commerce between the women, and everybody wins that way. So really what we're saying is, you know, take the lens out, you know, a few thousand feet. You know, don't be, you know, looking so myopically. You got to look at the whole system and how that system fits together, and it can be done. Yeah, it's a little more complicated, but we put a man on the moon, for God's sake. We can absolutely figure this out.
By the way, where are the men in the picture that you drew earlier of, you know, the majority of farmers in the world being women and the typical profile being a mother with a child in tow, working the fields? Are these single mother farmers, or are the men also farmers in the household growing the cash crops on another part of the land, or what's the picture there?
Well, let's take Africa. There are men that are farmers, but men also engage in other kinds of activities too. They might be in commerce, they might be laborers, they might have migrated from the village to the city to find a job. So women are the majority of farmers because they're the majority of the population that is in the villages. And men do contribute to their family's welfare with their earnings, but it's very normal and very typical and not viewed as a bad thing that a father's income, he uses part of it for the household, but really the rest of it is his to use as he sees fit on his entertainment, on buying a bicycle, on, you know, improving, you know, his house. Most families in Africa have separate huts for husbands and wives, so he might improve his own hut where he lives. You know, so, and that's very typical and very normal. And what we're trying to do is sort of draw and engage men into this conversation, because that's actually what works most effectively when you start helping men and women understand, particularly the men, to understand how much the women are really shouldering. Sometimes they just don't know. They just don't realize how much work and how draining it is on a woman to not only have to, you know, grow the food, but be responsible for the family's expenses.
And one more question on this. You profile in the book two major farming assistance programs, one in Honduras and one in Nicaragua. And the one in Nicaragua has a more explicit focus on gender-based training. So what was different?
Well, so what was really fantastic about that program is that this World Food Program project brought women together in the community who actually had not been farmers before and introduced them to farming so that they could begin to develop some income. But they didn't stop there. They then invited the fathers and husbands and sons of these women to be part of a training to help them understand, you know, this is what your wife or sister or mother is engaged in, and this is how it's going to help the family. Here's how you can help as a man and be engaged. And they began through that window to really explore some of the, you know, tough gender issues in Latin America around machismo and domestic violence. And, you know, they opened a conversation around farming that was a safe conversation to have, but they really went pretty deep with communities. And as a result, not only are the women succeeding in their business ventures, but they're reducing violence in the home, they're creating better partnerships between husbands and wives. So they really took on this issue of gender, not in some kind of superficial way, but very deeply, and it's having a really profound effect.
Ritu Sharma, co-founder of Women Thrive Worldwide, an advocacy organization that brings the interests of women to the attention of policymakers in D.C., and the author of a new book that's just out called Teach a Woman to Fish, Overcoming Poverty Around the Globe. And one final question, because I see that you also have a guide to Westerners who want to do something to help women in the developing world, whether it's charity-based or policy or advocacy or conscious shopping. You gave some very interesting pointers before on which microloan organizations you think are worthy of supporting. What about in general for well-meaning Westerners who want to do something to chip in here, who aren't personally involved?
I'd say there's two things that are the most powerful to do, and one is use your voice. You know, I learned that the U.S. government, despite what we all think, really does listen to people, and using your voice to reach out to Congress. I know you just heard from Charlie Rangel. You know, they need to hear from us. And if you want to do that, you can go on our website, womenthrive.org, click on Take Action. We'll walk you through how to do that. And the other is just to shop more consciously. You know, when you go into a store, ask the clerk, you know, hey, do you have an ethical trade policy, or do you have, you know, some policy around making sure that everything is made, you know, with no child labor and no slave labor? Just even asking that question can have a dramatic effect on retail. So I would say those two things are a great way to start.
Ritu Sharma, thank you so much. Good luck to you and your organization.
Thanks.